stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing back-to-back interviews with two of the primary players in the up-and-coming production of Bonnie and Clyde the Musical at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. The first interview is with Bonnie herself, Laura Osnes, who has played Bonnie in every permutation that this show has had and who I'm sure is looking forward to playing it on Broadway. The second interview is with Don Black. Don Black is the lyricist for this show and has been the lyricist on almost everything you can name. I will be giving his credits. Well, I'll be giving some of his credits. There's no way to give all of Don's credits, even if I had the whole show to do it in. Anyway, these are interesting people with interesting points of view and interesting lives. So hang on. Here comes the show. The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering who you really are, maybe why you had to hide some of who you really are, and then figuring out whether you can resurrect some of what you had to hide. That is what I talk about in most of the shows. At least I talk about that for the first part of the show. Today, I'm not going to talk that much about that. So if you're interested in that, curious about that, wondering about that, if you haven't heard the show before, and this is the first time you've heard me talk about the fact that I believe that we're all keeping secrets about ourselves, and not just from other people, but from ourselves as well. So if you're curious about that, you can tune in next week, and when I am almost certainly going to be talking more about that. Or you can go to my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, don't leave the E out of Lynn, you'll get a different Lynn Show. And there are all kinds of podcasts, 3 years worth of podcasts up there, in which I am talking about how to discover what you've hidden, why you might have hidden it, how to recover it, and what kind of obstacles there are to recovering, even when you have discovered and want to recover. The other thing I do in my show is I interview people who make their living or their life within art. And today I am, actually next week as well, I think, dedicating the entire show to interview as opposed to Lynn talk. Today, if you were listening to the opening of the show, you know I am playing an interview with Laura Osnes, who is the Bonnie of Bonnie and Clyde the musical. And she has a very delightful, very charming, very surprising, in some ways, story. Not the typical story of starving artist and struggle, but a rather delightful story of, wow, it just happened. And you can hear some of why this just happened to her when you listen. The delight in her voice, the energy, the passion, the happiness, the joy. And as my next guest says, the sparkle. Actually, I think that Laura talks about the sparkle as well. And after my interview with Laura, I'm interviewing Don Black, who wrote the lyrics for Bonnie and Clyde the musical. I'll talk a little bit more about him after Laura's interview. But as I said, these interviews take up the whole show, so I'm going to let Laura speak for herself. And here she is, Bonnie herself, Laura Osnes. So I am here with Laura Osnes, who is the lucky Bonnie of Bonnie and Clyde. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, yes. And you've done it before?
Yes, I have. I've been a part of the project for almost 2 years. I did two readings of it in New York and then did the La Jolla production last year.
And here you are at the Oslo.
Exactly.
All right, okay. So let me tell you what I do. Sure. I interview people who make their living or their life within art.
Uh-huh.
And I always ask the same question, and it is, how did it happen to you?
Okay, well, it started at a young age for me. I did my first show in second grade, and I was a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, my God. All right, second grade, you would be six, eight?
Seven, probably.
Seven.
Yep.
And so now you did your first show at seven.
Yes.
I'm assuming you had some interest in it before that, or you wouldn't...
I did. I started taking dance when I was five. So uh-huh. I was a dancer first, I guess, and then... I did The Wizard of Oz, and I loved The Wizard of Oz, and I actually did it with, like, two of my best friends. My stepsister was in it. It was like a family affair. So, and then...
It was a great way to start.
Exactly.
But let me back you up even just a little more.
Okay.
You started to take dance at five. Is that because you said, Mommy, I want to dance, or is that because Mommy said, listen, what about a dance class?
To be honest, I don't remember. I think, I was always very musical, and I never felt forced. I loved dance, I don't remember if I was the one who initiated it or if
yeah,
she did.
Yeah, yeah, but it always felt right. It always felt good.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And when you say you were always musical, does that mean that you would sing too, or just dance around? Or?
I sang Castle on a Cloud from Les Mis at my kindergarten talent show. So I was definitely already musicals.
Right.
I used to act them out in my living room. Secret Garden, Les Mis, and Miss Saigon. I would act out in my living room when I was young.
That's great. That's great. So, it was a natural, it came to you naturally, right?
Yeah.
And your family liked it, was okay with it, appreciated it.
I would say my family is very musical. Both my parents love to sing. My mom plays a little piano. My dad plays guitar. But neither of them were ever really theatrical. I kind of have that kind of as my own. I feel like I get to claim, and I definitely roped my dad into doing community theater with me into high school and as I got older. I definitely get the musical thing from my family, but I'm kind of the first that's been theatrical.
Theatrical, I love it. Okay, so we have you at seven in your first show, and we have you in your first show in the living room, essentially, right?
right.
But then the first on a stage with an audience that's not your family. And this feels really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah. Okay. So, then what?
And then I just kind of kept auditioning. The next show I did, I was Amaryllis in The Music Man. And it was at the high school, at the local high school. And obviously I was a student, as a kid, still in elementary school. But the director was a man named Dennis Swanson, who I remember working with when I was in third grade, and he was still the director when I got to high school. Mm. Once I got to high school, so he was still teaching there and directing all the shows. So
you had one school through high
school? No, it was like an elementary school, middle school, and a high school.
Right.
But I was in the high school show when I was 8 years old, because they needed
a kid.
Oh,
I see.
Because they needed
a kid. Of course, Munchkins.
Right. Well, this was Amaryllis.
We need kids. I got it. Oh, I see.
So they hired kids from the local elementary school to be in the high school production.
Right. So by the time you got to high school, he was still there, and he remembered you from...
Of course. We worked several times in between there when they needed other kids, and then I got to high school, and I still got to do all his shows. So, and by then, by the time I got to high school, I pretty much knew that this is what I wanted to do.
I
was also still doing competitive dance at the time and ended up quitting dance in 10th grade to do theater because I was starting, both of them wanted my full time and it was hard to do both.
Yeah, do you know why you chose one over the other?
I think because in theater I can do all three, dancing, singing, and acting, and in dance I can only dance, which I love to dance, and I took dance for 15 years, so I love that, but in theater I kind of get to do them all.
Yeah, and you didn't say this, and maybe when you're a kid you don't think this, but... A dancer's career is much more limited than an actor's career.
It's very true. It's very true. And I mean, I didn't take point. Like, I learned the styles of dance that I did were tap, jazz, and lyrical, more of the even theatrical kinds of
right,
dance.
Right, right, right.
So, that, I don't know, I found that I loved it and that I could do all three
on
stage.
Okay, so around the 10th grade, you're saying you...
That's when I quit dance, and I was like, okay, if I want to do the show at school, if I want to... And I also did professional shows in Minneapolis, which is where I'm from, while I was in high school. And just kept up with my homework. And then by my junior year in high school, I did post-secondary education, which is where you take some classes at a college. And it's not like AP classes in high school. I actually only had high school 3 days a week, and then I went to, like, college 2 days a week, and it was able to, like... free up my schedule so that I could do theater. So I had a little bit of a weird high school experience. And then by my senior year, I was only taking a couple classes at high school. And then I was doing a professional production of The Wizard of Oz, and my school actually worked with me and gave me credit, like school credit to do it.
Oh, that's lovely.
So they were wonderful, knowing that this is what I really wanted to do, and I was getting work experience.
This is an unusual school experience, I think.
Yes. I would say most people do not have the high school experience that I had.
Absolutely right.
But my high school has a fantastic arts program, and so I think they were just, trying to support me and believe in me, too. And I'm really happy they let me do that because it obviously paid off.
Oh, my God, yes. All right, so you mentioned the director, Dennis Swanson.
Yeah. Very good.
It sounded like you were going to say more about him. Did I miss that?
Well, I ended up doing, like, three more productions with him when I was in high school, and then he also directs every summer theater production that I roped my dad into doing. I did probably five summer shows with him, too, throughout my middle school and high school years.
All musicals? Some drama?
All musicals. One play. I've only ever done one play in my life, and it was The Miracle Worker.
My God.
He directed that.
That's pretty serious stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were Annie Sullivan?
Yeah.
It's a pretty serious role.
Yeah, it's a great role.
Okay, so we have you sort of, we have you actually in your career in high school.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you're doing professional productions even in high school, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Outside of school, yeah, in the city.
So then what?
So then I graduated high school, and I started looking at colleges, and I got the opportunity to visit a lot of colleges, so that was really nice. And I could actually see myself at two of them that I visited, and that was Cincinnati Conservatory and Stevens Point, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin. Random, but
no, wait. I've never heard anybody quite say that, so I'd like to know if you can look at it a little more deeply and tell me what that means. I could see myself at these schools, as opposed to I couldn't see myself at these schools.
Sure. Well. Because I got to visit a lot of them, you kind of get a feel for the campus, and you go, this is something I...
Are you talking about the physical layout? This is pretty to me, it's not...
Both things. Physical, the feel of it. I don't know, the town,
yes.
The campus, if it's
the vibe?
Contained... The vibe. The vibe. There you go.
Yeah.
And it is kind of... It's hard to explain. You know
yes,
what I mean?
No, I believe you. I believe you. And I think... I just want to stay with it for a minute, because I think... I think something that is really underrated in our society is what you and I are now talking about. The sense that something is right.
Yeah.
What we're calling the vibe,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and that as I asked you to define it, mostly in our culture,
yeah.
People are looking for much more concrete kinds of, you know, they have the best reputation in the country. They have the teacher
of
the, you know, right. But there's this other sort of magical
sixth sense
thing,
yeah.
Right? Okay. So, so did you apply to both of them, or did
I applied and auditioned to both, and I didn't make it into Cincinnati. So, Stephen's point it was, and it was actually kind of nice because it was 3 hours from home, and they happened to have an amazing musical theater program, and I loved it there. I learned a lot, but I only went to college for a year. And then I was offered a full-time apprenticeship position at a theater I worked at growing up in Minneapolis, the Children's Theater Company, which is where I did The Wizard of Oz.
Did you apply? Or did you know what was there?
No, the director from there, because I had worked with him as well, Matthew Howe, who's also a huge influence in my acting career, I would say. A director I knew from there approached me and said, "How would you ever consider leaving school for a really great opportunity?" And I was like, well,
wow.
Dish it to me.
Yeah, right.
It was a big decision, but I thought school is something that will always be there, and an opportunity might always not be there. So I decided to leave school for then and take this year-long apprenticeship, and it was at a theater I grew up working at, so I already knew everybody.
Right.
I knew it would be an incredible, fun experience.
Right.
Plus, I was getting paid, and I got to be in every show of the season and understudy lead roles and all this stuff.
Okay, stop for a second.
And that's also where I met my husband during that year.
This is another one of those, the conventional wisdom says, you should graduate from college, right? You know.
Yes.
So now.
And from Juilliard and from all these.
Yes, right,
people,
right, exactly, like, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm just curious. I'm assuming that you went to school the way pretty much everybody goes to school, because it was to college. It was the next rung on the ladder. You knew you needed to go, so
yeah.
You were going.
But I did have an unconventional high school experience. So my parents were definitely kind of supportive the whole time of whatever door kind of seemed to open, whatever path seemed right. Same thing, this thing you were talking about. So I'm really glad that I went to school for a year, but they were completely in support of me.
Yeah,
that's
clear. What I'm curious to look at is, did you think when you went to school that there was something particular you expected to get there?
Gosh, that's a good question.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
Yes, in a way, because I think it is so, like, it's weird saying, I don't have a college degree. But on one hand, I guess I'm confident enough in who I am that it's not degrading me as a person, at least for me, to say that. Some people need that in their life. To be like, okay, I'm successful because I have a college degree. Or I feel better about myself if I have a college degree.
Yes.
That's never something I've had my, like, sights set on. I think there is something, the stamp of saying, yes, I went to this school, or yes, I graduated with a BFA in musical theater. You know, not to say it's not a wonderful thing. Obviously, it's fantastic, and I think training in a school is wonderful, but also so is experience in the real world.
You know, what I was thinking, it's interesting that you answered it the way you did, because that wasn't what I was thinking. What I was thinking was that there were things you might want to learn that would help you to do what you want to do, and the traditional route is the BFA in musical theater, right? So that was the route you were on, but I'm guessing you got, or you expected to get, that where you went. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, that the training that you might have expected to get in school, you could also have gotten in that 1 year apprenticeship, or am I wrong about that?
Oh, yes. I mean, yes, I think, yeah, the 1 year, it's true, because it's like you train at school and you learn all these things, but then the experience of doing the 1 year apprenticeship is just as valuable, if not more.
Right, in terms of what you're getting.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. You're still honing your skills doing this thing. It's just a different working environment.
That's right. That was what I was getting at. So it was real interesting that you brought up the piece of paper, the credential, the prop, the,
yeah,
you know, a thing. Because I agree with you that, as I said before, it's the conventional wisdom. You need to have that,
yeah,
you know, because that somehow legitimizes you. But I think it's quite clear that what legitimizes you is your work, you know.
Hopefully, yes.
Well, clearly, yes.
Yeah.
You know, clearly, yes. So, okay, so we have this year.
And the good thing about theater is that, yes, it can help you to have that on your resume, but there is something else. There's the work, there's a natural knack, there's that extra sparkle that can't be taught,
no,
and a love for the arts that can't be taught, and that some people have and some people don't.
And you can't get it even if you have a BFA in musical theater. Right, 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 right. And clearly you've had this since the living room.
Yes.
You know, I mean, so you didn't have to get that there, and you also probably had more experience than most of the people that you were in school with by the time you went to school, right?
Probably, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so now we have you in the one-year apprenticeship, and you do all this work, you do everything,
yep,
and now that's over, so then what happens?
So I did that for a year. Mm-hmm. I debated about going back to school the next fall, and I ended up getting cast in a production of Grease at a dinner theater for the fall in Minnesota, and as Sandy. And I was like, well, another leading role in a professional theater in Minneapolis. I guess I'll
put it off yet again.
If I'm getting work, if I'm going to school for what I actually want to do, and I'm actually getting work without the school, it's like, okay, again, the opportunity may not always be there. I'll take the opportunity. I could always go back to school.
Right.
So decided to take the show.
And I want to stop you again, because I can always go back to school, but what for? I mean, if you find a reason sometime in your life,
right,
that there's something you want to learn or new
skills besides theater.
That's right, but you don't seem to need to go to school for this career because the career just keeps coming to you.
Thankfully, yes, so far.
Yeah,
it's been
yeah,
a huge blessing.
Well, no, it's probably not. I mean, clearly it's a blessing, but it's probably just deserved. I mean, you know,
both ways. I think it's a little of both: the right place, the right time, the right opportunity,
and the right person.
Yeah.
All right, okay. So you got this lead role in Grease.
So I got the lead role in Grease, and I was doing that show, and then all of a sudden there was things in the newspaper that NBC was casting Sandy and Danny in Grease on Broadway through a reality show. And all my friends were like, Laura, you should audition. You're playing Sandy right now. You should go. And I was like, this is crazy. The director will never let me go. It's a regional production. I still have 2 months that I'm supposed to be doing this show. I still have 2 more months I'm supposed to be doing Grease. How can I go to L.A. and audition for this when there's an understudy that, you know, has not gone on and, you know, whatever. So I asked the director, for some reason I still, again, felt it on my heart that I really needed to go do this thing. Mm-hmm. I was like, gosh, are they going to let me? how should I do this? I ended up asking the director. I said, here's this opportunity. I want to run it past you. Think about it. If it's not okay for me to go, fine. If you think there's a way that we can make it work, fine. Let me know. And he said, yeah, I think we can make this work. So my understudy went on for a week while I went to L.A. and auditioned for this reality show. And I ended up making it to the top six, and I had to leave that show early. They all understood because I was going on to this bigger thing, and I was going to be on TV, and the understudy took over full-time.
No, she must have loved it.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Yes, a blessing for everybody.
Exactly.
Right, right, right.
And I ended up winning that reality show. So I got transplanted to New York City. I got married after I won. I went back to Minnesota, got married, and my husband and I moved to New York together, and I got to do Grease on Broadway for a year, and that
oh
was
my
Broadway debut.
Wow.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm thinking is, not only have all these things sort of fallen on you, you know, I mean, you have not essentially said, what should I do now? Let me go get something,
yeah,
you know, but you have had so much support. I mean, people have been so willing to assist you on your road.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And it also, for me, you know, suggests that it's the right road.
Hmm.
you know, because...
Me too.
Because for a lot of people, obstacles get thrown in their way all the time. And for you, they just can't, they're not there.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, when was this, Greece?
That was 2007.
All right.
I won the show, got married, and then we opened on August 19th of 2007 and ran for a year to 2008. And then I had the rest of the year off. I did a couple little projects for the rest of 2008. And then in 2009, I was cast as a replacement in South Pacific on Broadway. I replaced Kelly O'Hara, who was on maternity leave. She was going to have a baby.
Oh, my God.
So I went into audition for that and, again, thought it was a long shot and ended up getting hired to take over for her as the lead in South Pacific.
You're a little young, aren't you?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, I'm 10 years too young for this role. And
so what did they do? Put gray in your hair?
No. The thing is, she's supposed to be fresh out of nursing school.
Oh, right. That's
the whole
right,
point
right.
is... That right. she's, you know, the he's a cultured Frenchman, I'm a little hick. It's
right,
a line
right.
in the thing. And
right, right.
he sings, she's younger than I, and this young girl climbing up my hill. And
yeah, right.
So it works.
So it works, right.
But I had four callbacks. I had four auditions for that. And my final callback, they brought in Paolo Schott, who was playing Emile, and we read together.
Oh.
And the director actually called me before that audition and said, Laura, we want to bring you in one more time to read with Paolo because we didn't think we would go with someone this young. He said it to me over the phone.
Right.
And I was like, okay. He's like, we just want to make sure it's going to work with you and him. So, did it, thankfully. And that was the best next step I could have ever hoped for, especially after being Sandy and doing the reality show thing. It kind of legitimized me
yes.
in New York City
yes.
as being more than that.
Yes. You're not just a reality
for.
Star.
Yeah. Which I was very grateful for.
Yeah.
And I did that show for 7 months, and then she came back for a while, and I did the La Jolla production last year. I left South Pacific for 3 months to do the La Jolla production, and then returned in January.
To do the La Jolla production of...
Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Yes.
Yeah, right. You need to say it. They don't know.
Yeah, sorry. Right. Exactly. Right.
So how did that happen?
Again.
Yes,
okay.
I love it.
Perfection here. So Kelly was taking 7 months off because she was pregnant. So I was scheduled to go on March 10th to October 6th was my contract with South Pacific. And October 4th was my last show, a Sunday. And then I found out that, meanwhile, that was the year I was also doing the two readings of Bonnie and Clyde in New York City. The show was getting on its feet, and it was getting picked up to go to La Jolla Playhouse. And
so you were already doing the reading, so you must have auditioned for that.
For Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah.
I initially I went in to sing for Frank for one of his Frank Wildhorn who wrote the music for Bonnie and Clyde. I initially auditioned for him for one of his other musicals, Wonderland, the Alice in Wonderland show that he's been doing. And he said, "You sound amazing, but I think you're a little too young for Alice, but you might be perfect for this other show I have that I've been working on, Bonnie and Clyde." So we continued to. He got me the music for that, and Frank and I continued to meet and learn the music for Bonnie and Clyde over the next couple months. And,
well, you were doing readings and backwards auditions and stuff like that, or not?
No, just I wasn't a part of Bonnie and Clyde yet. This was I was just singing with Frank, learning the music, and mm-hmm. he was the one that ended up convincing Jeff Calhoun and the creative team to let me be Bonnie. So I didn't even really have
yet again
to audition. I just kind of worked with Frank, and we sang the stuff, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked them into letting me be Bonnie. So that was great. So, yes, I was doing the readings of Bonnie and Clyde during South Pacific, and I was singing with Frank before South Pacific. And then, so my South Pacific contract was up August 4th, and rehearsals for Bonnie and Clyde were going to start in La Jolla on October 6th.
Holy cow.
So I had a day off to fly to California and start rehearsal for Bonnie and Clyde. And then I did it in La Jolla last year for 2-3 months, whatever it was, had off for Christmas, and then... Kelly was leaving South Pacific January 4th, and they asked me to come back.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
It was perfect. I started right up again in 2010 with South Pacific for another 8 months, and then the show closed in August, the end of this August.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've been working pretty steadily since I moved to New York, which is...
Amazing.
Amazing.
Yes.
It's been wonderful, but it's kind of been the perfect balance. Because between things, I've had like a month or two off, or like even a week to go home for Christmas last year was like great. And actually, between South Pacific and the Sarasota production of Bonnie and Clyde, I had a month off. My husband and I went to Italy for 2.5 weeks. So I'm definitely feeling like I've had enough time to catch up, and I'm excited to be here working again.
So. All right. And so here you are, and Bonnie and Clyde will run from...
November All the posters are saying November 16th is when we start previews, and opening is November 19th, and then we close December 19th.
So in time to go home for Christmas.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's a glorious story. It's really a glorious story.
And Bonnie's very fun to play.
Is she?
Yes.
Why?
She's unlike any role I've ever played. I usually play the good girl ingenue.
Yes,
Bonnie, I get to be a little bit darker, so it's fun.
Yeah, a little bit harder, too, mm-hmm. huh?
Yes, and exactly, and it's the Depression. It's 1930s, and it's hard times.
Yeah. That's great. Okay, so I'd like to ask, is there anything I didn't ask you that I should have?
Gosh, well, it depends. If you want to talk more about the show, we kind of talked about my past, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
If you're going to kind of tell my story, that's great.
Well, that's what I'm mostly interested in. If there's something you want to say about the show, you should.
Just
come and see it. Absolutely.
See for yourself.
Right. Come and see it. Absolutely.
Exactly.
And so the only other question I usually ask is, it's clear that you have dedicated your life to this work.
Hmm.
And so if there's anything you want to say about what that feels like, what that the experience is like, to be completely immersed in a work and give your life to it. So if there's anything you want to say about that, this would be the time.
I guess this is the thing that I found that I'm the most passionate about. And I wanted to pursue it since I was 5, and I have. And I feel so fortunate that I've gotten so many amazing opportunities to get to do what I love. I literally pinch myself every day. I get to go to work and play dress up and play house and play. You know, it's like, I can't believe I get paid to do what I love.
To play.
That's why it's called a play.
Yes,
there's a reason it's called a play.
I know.
So it is. It's fantastic, and it's unbelievably rewarding to look back and even telling you the journey. Like, I get emotional even just telling you the journey of my story.
It's pretty moving.
Yeah, it's kind of just kismet. And
yes.
It's perfect.
Yes, there's a Yiddish word for it. It's bashert. Have you ever heard it?
No.
It means meant to be. They usually use it for, like, your beloved. This is your bashert. But you can also use it for a work. It is though it was bashert for you. It was meant for you, you know.
For you.
And truly, it sounds like it was meant for you. And so I will be curious to see where you go from here.
Well, thank you.
And maybe we'll do a follow-up in a couple of years and do the next step. That would be great. Okay, we're actually done.
Perfect.
I have to explain the abrupt end to that interview. I don't usually end interviews that way, but Laura and Don, who was my next interview, and all of the people associated with Bonnie and Clyde the musical, were doing interviews that day. And we were allocated just a certain amount of time. I usually like to do longer interviews, but this is what we had, so this is what we got. And the person who sets up the interviews, the astounding Julia Guzman, was there at the door letting us know that the interview was over. And so you hear me saying, well, yes, okay, all right, we're actually over now. She escorted Laura out to whatever was the next thing on Laura's agenda, and she went and got me Don, who is just delightful and who was very disgruntled. You can really hear it at the beginning of the interview, especially because he was in the middle of rewriting a lyric for the show, which is opening in a very short period of time. But he interrupted his creative process to come and talk to me. And I am very appreciative because it's a lovely interview. And he has a very unique way of looking at writing and his work, which you will hear coming up now. Here we got Don Black.
Hi, I'm here with Don Black.
What's left of Don Black?
What's left of Don Black, who harriedly, generously, kindly admitted to take time out of the creative process. He's in the middle of writing a song for the show that's about to go on, and he's taken time to do this, which I am grateful for. I know you are grateful for. And hopefully we won't be too oppressive to Don.
No. Okay. Be gentle with me. Really.
I'm trying. I'm really trying. Okay, so I do an internet radio show. I interview people who make their living or their life within art.
Right.
I always ask them the same question. How did it happen to you? How did it find you? How did you find it?
What's your next question? No, well, it's, you know, things happen. You know, I've always loved words and songs.
Yeah.
And I was doing it and writing, and suddenly you get a bit of success, and once a bit of success comes along, you just build from there. I mean,
it's a long story. Yes, well, we have a little bit of time.
No. I come from the East End of London, and I was in a music publisher. I was a stand-up comedian for a while.
Oh, Don, stop. When was the very first time you thought, I either am in love with music, or I am in love with words, or I seem to like words, or I seem to put them together?
Well, I can tell you. I can tell you exactly.
Yeah.
Because it came about as a result of an embarrassment.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I was at home with my brothers and sisters. I have two brothers, two sisters.
How old were you?
I was about 8, 9, or 10, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember looking at the newspaper. My sister was going to see a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, are you going to see They Made Me a Fugitive?
And they fell out.
Oh, she burst out laughing. And everyone was making fun, because it was fugitive was the word.
Uh-huh.
And they made me a fugitive. And I don't know what, I always remember that moment, because then I looked it up in the dictionary, fugitive. And from then on, because there was an embarrassment involved in it, I think I remember going to my teacher at school saying, what does ubiquitous mean, or what does this mean and that mean?
Because it became important for you to know what words meant.
Yeah.
Right. So it's interesting, because I thought something else that you didn't say, and I don't think it's true. I thought, well, he got a rise. You know, he got a reaction. And maybe that was what you liked, but it wasn't.
No, it's just the fact, I find it very embarrassing. Still to this day, I mean, when you're working with the kind of people I've worked with,
mm-hmm.
and they're very smart people, it's the most terrible thing if you don't know what they're talking. You know, if they say a word and you don't know, and you're sitting there with Trevor Nunn, the director, who's brilliant, and he says, well, I think it should be more sagacious or something.
Oh, dear God.
You know, it's nice to know that you can have a conversation with these people. So I've made a big deal out of vocabulary.
So words became, and their meaning and what it meant about you to know them became really important very young.
That's right.
But there were a lot of ways you could have gone with that.
Well, it's true, but then I also loved songs. And then I also remember hearing early on songs like, words like Fish Gotta Swim, Birds Gotta Fly, I Gotta Love One Man Till I Die. And I think that's so beautiful. First of all, it's true.
Yes.
Fish have gotta swim, birds have gotta fly. And I just thought it was very good. And
the connection between the imperative for birds and fish and then what it feels like to have to love.
That's right, the simplicity of it, but to say it in such a simple way.
Yeah.
But of course you don't study this, you just carry on and you write your own songs.
Well,
and the first hit I had, because I did lots of rubbishy nothing, but my first successful song was a song called Walk Away, and it was about a man who tells a girl, walk away, please go, before you throw your life away. It was an older man saying to a younger woman, don't waste your time with me. And it was a big success and in England. And it was a mature lyric.
Yes.
You know, because
it wasn't Moon June.
No. It was a proper thing that a lot of people could relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And it touched a lot of people.
Yes.
And as a result of that, John Barry, the great composer, asked me if I'd like to do a James Bond film, which I did, Thunderball, and then I got into movies, and it was on my way.
It was the result, really, of Walk Away?
It really was, because it was the kind of song that people noticed. You know, some songs come and go.
Yes, yes,
but this was a ballad, but sung by a man called Matt Monro.
I know who he is.
And if you ever...
I do.
If you can, you can slip it in now.
Well, actually...
Play a bit of it.
Actually, I do want to.
Okay, do that.
I need to have it.
You can get it on the net, of course. On YouTube.
On YouTube?
Of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Matt Monro, Walk Away, he's all over the place.
I will definitely slip it in.
Okay.
And actually, now that we're talking about that, is there anything else I can slip in?
You can get everything up on YouTube.
And I will, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's my great pleasure when I interview musicians, especially people who make music,
right,
to play their... to play their stuff. Okay, so there's a big leap here. I mean, we have this 8-year-old boy who becomes interested in, attached to the importance of words. Mm. And then we have Walk Away.
Right.
I'm assuming that's a few years later.
Yeah.
Are you saying that you just started to write poetry or songs? Or
poetry is different to lyrics.
Yes.
Poetry is to be written and pondered on. Lyrics, you know, instant. I've always followed Colt Porter and Irving Berlin. I just love all those songs. And if you
did you write music yourself?
No.
So you had to find composers then?
Yes, that's right, I did.
So how did you do that?
Composers are always looking for lyric writers.
Yes. Well,
they were then. Nowadays, everyone writes songs. Every waiter writes songs.
You know, yes.
Which is fine. That's another story. But I think it was very smart of me to concentrate only on lyrics, because there are very few lyric writers in the world who only write lyrics. But there's lots of composers.
How interesting. Mm. That's good to know.
Yeah.
As I am also a lyricist.
Are you?
Oh. Okay. Yes, so I do know something about not only falling in love with words, but falling in love with finding a way to say something that is meaningful and yet hasn't been said that way.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the trick.
The trick is to say something. For me, the trick is to touch a nerve. And say, if someone says to me after a song of mine, "I felt that."
Yes.
Then I think you've cracked it.
Yes, I agree. I agree. It's so interesting to me that this passion, you know, this desire to touch people with words,
yeah,
comes out of an embarrassment.
It's
ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's. I mean, that's a long time ago.
Oh, no, I know.
It's deeply embedded in me.
Well, clearly, you remember it.
Yeah,
and
probably.
I would guess that when you think of it, you can even re-experience a little bit of the feeling that you had.
I can. I'm sitting in that kitchen and I'm talking to my sister.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And you know, it's important. This is important for me because I'm also a psychotherapist.
Are you?
And yeah, and the importance of...
You're good to know. Lyric writing psychotherapist.
That's right. Ta-da, ta-da, ta-da. Right. But so often people want to forget or discount or ignore or deny their early experiences. They say, "That happened to me when I was so little, it doesn't matter."
Graham Greene, the great author, once said, "An unhappy childhood is a writer's gold mine." And I completely disagree with him, because I had a fabulous childhood.
Yes.
With a wonderful mother and father, wonderful, just love all the way, and could not have been improved. And yet, you know, I write about sad things, terrible things, you know, so I think that's a lot of hooey. You know?
I agree. Yeah. And see, I think it's a dangerous myth,
yeah,
that not only writers, but, you know, artists have to suffer, in order to create.
Yeah,
and
clearly
that isn't the truth, in my view. But you don't get people saying that very often, so
no. Thank
you very much.
Okay.
We want to send that message out to everybody
right.
who had a nice childhood and wants to write.
Exactly.
Yes, right. By all means, right. And also, I mean, maybe you mean this, but happy childhood and love and comfort,
mm-hmm,
that doesn't mean you don't experience any pain in your life, or that you don't know what it means to be in, you know, to have pain in your life. None of us gets out of it, entirely.
Of course.
And so it seems to me that it's the willingness to express that in a way that's not, in an honest way.
Right.
You know, really how it feels.
Well, it depends what you're writing. You know, as a lyric writer for many different moods,
mm-hmm,
it depends what is required of you. You know, if I'm writing a happy song, you write a happy song. I mean, also, you can analyze these things too much, you know, talking to a psychiatrist.
I was just going to say, I can't believe you want to say that to me.
No, but I think you can. I notice in America,
mm-hmm,
this is going to be very controversial, but there's an overemphasis, I think, of self-analysis. To me, one of the greatest lessons I've learned is a book I read years ago by Joseph Cotten, the actor.
Mm-hmm.
And he said in a book that one of the greatest lessons he's learned for staying sane in this business and keeping,
mm-hmm,
yourself together and normal, and this was his phrase, "Keep your mind off your mind."
I love it.
And I thought, you know, that is so true. Once you start thinking too much about yourself, thinking too much of how I write, thinking too much, having theories on this, and you know, I think, you know, forget it, but just get on with it. And Julie Stein, the great composer, once said to me, inspiration is for amateurs.
Ah.
That's another great phrase as well. Get on with it. It's a job.
You know, another sort of line, the thing that came to mind for me is Spencer Tracy, when they asked him what his technique for acting was, he said, find your mark and say your lines.
That's exactly. Pick everything to pieces, but I never analyze how I do, because people say to me, how can you write about Bonnie and Clyde? I come from the East End of London. This is Dust Bowl, 1930s. I don't know. You just read it, set up, and do it. You know, that's what you do. I don't analyze it.
I was not suggesting that you should, really. No. You know, I think that there's a kind of natural skill, the ability to put yourself in a situation, to find in yourself the things that resonate with that situation, whether you grew up there or you had that experience or not.
Right.
It's a universal kind of, you know, you're a human being and they are human beings. And so you have that, you have access to that inside yourself.
Right.
And you don't have to analyze it. And I also think there's a kind of magic about writing. Anyway, I think there is. I don't know, maybe other people don't, but
right.
Something that you can't, there's a connection that gets made inside that you're not even necessarily aware of,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
So one couldn't analyze it, you know.
No, well, I never bother with it. Just get on with it.
No, I see. Okay, so anybody else in your family choose to be in the arts?
Not really. My sons are in the record business.
And aha!
I have a son who's a songwriter, another son who's in the record business.
In Britain?
In Britain, yeah, mm-hmm. In London. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where are you from? You from here? Oh, I shouldn't ask you questions.
That's all right. You can ask me whatever you want. I am. Okay. You mean from here, meaning?
You live in Sarasota?
I do now.
Oh, right.
I do now.
From where?
Well, I came here from L.A.
Right.
And I went there from New York.
Okay. All right.
Does it fit?
Yeah, it makes sense. You've got a lot to write about.
Yes, I have a lot to write about. You've been writing a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, but if Walk Away was the thing that triggered the success for you, do you mind my asking how old you were when that happened?
Young. I was, probably about 19, 20.
So oh, wow. Out. So you really, it did really happen for you very quickly.
Well, it didn't seem quickly. Or maybe it was 22 or something like that. But, you know, I left school at 15, so then you're working, so it's like 6-7 years of working. And
yeah, so 6-7 years of trying to write songs.
Yeah.
Of connecting with the composers who were desperate to have lyricists.
That's
and
right,
yeah, right. It is pretty quick, actually.
It is quick.
I mean, if you
but
look
you know,
at
the thing is, you know, I got this award the other night and for being voted Icon of the Year, which is incredible. The reason I mention it is is in my speech, I talked about my failures. I said, you know, because there was a big thing about adulation and what I've done and what I've achieved. But I just wanted to remind people of the flops I've had, you know. It's a good thing to do that because so many things haven't worked. Yes, I've had great success, but, you know, things don't work. And it's good to remind people.
It's not only good, it's essential.
Yeah.
I was actually just talking the other day on a show about how problematic it is for people who can't risk failure, for whom failure is so terrifying that they don't risk. It is the, I mean, this is an old cliche, you know, that it's the ability to risk failure that allows you to move on to success.
Right.
So how nice of you not to continue the myth.
That no, exactly. Not everything you do. And you can waste years on a project.
Yes.
And that doesn't work. And you think, oh, my God, the time, wait, the meetings and the running around and something.
And the work.
The work, the time. But you wasted so much time on something. Mm-hmm. I used to think that, but then again, you know, I looked at people like Lerner and Lowe,
mm-hmm.
and all the flops they had. Never mind about My Fair Lady and Camelot.
Yeah.
You know, I can name, you know, half a dozen shows that they wrote that no one's ever heard of,
uh-huh.
that they spent years on, that opened and closed in weeks. So, yeah, it's a great leveler.
It is, and also, one of the things I like to do in my show, one of the things the show is about, is helping people figure out that some of what they might think they are is not all they are, that there may be more to them that they know about.
Sure.
And one of the reasons I interview artists is because in order to be an artist, at least in this culture, it has to be who you really are, because we make it so hard for artists. You have to have no choice in a way. Just think for a second about what it has felt like to dedicate an entire life to words, to writing. And is there anything you would say about it?
Well, people have said to me lately a lot, you know, that I've devoted, because I've written over 1,000 songs. And, you know, when it's put to you like that, because you don't realize you just keep writing year after year after year, but someone said I've written over 1,000 songs. Yeah, well, you know, it's the greatest thing, writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met a lot of people who've devoted their lives to writing songs, and they never lose their twinkle. Old songwriters, you know, people, great, they still have that bounce about them and that spring in their step. And I think it's a very useful thing, you know, it keeps you young. I wouldn't change anything. I really wouldn't change it to do something else. I've enjoyed it, and I think it's given some pleasure to my family, if nothing else. And it's given us all a nice life. And what better way to sit down and just dream, really, and walk around parks and stare out of windows.
Yes,
and meet people like you.
It's lovely. Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Lynn, very much.
Sit down and just dream. Walk around parks and stare out of windows and look inside yourself for what is going to touch another human being. It's so lovely, isn't it? That he can think of what he does after the 1,000 songs, after all of the crunch times and the trying to be different people in different situations, and that he can still think of it as this lovely, sweet, I don't know, engaging activity. And just to say that he too still has that twinkle that old songwriters have, and I hope that's true about the twinkle in an old songwriter myself. Well, I very much wanted to play some, at least something, from Don Black's extraordinary repertoire, but I'm about out of time. So I'm not going to be able to do it in this show, but I will do it in a show coming up. I will have more time in another show, and at that time I will also give you more of his credits. I'll just talk a little bit more about him. In the meanwhile, again, as always, if you are curious about the work that I do, discovering who you are, uncovering what you might be hiding, figuring out why you needed to pretend that something was true of you when it really wasn't. Just recently, I had a conversation with a woman who discovered that she was the caretaker of her family. She had never realized it. This was a surprising discovery. And also that she had hidden undercover, as I say, her desire not to be everybody's caretaker. Maybe that sounds familiar to you. Maybe that rings a bell for you. Well, if you're curious about that, as I said, please tune in again. Go up to the website, thelinshow.com. Don't forget the E in Lynn. Of course, all this information comes from the book that I wrote, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And there's a workbook and also an audio book. So if you go up on the website, you can check them out. And I currently, oh my gosh, I didn't say, well, I said it in the interview, didn't I, that I'm a psychotherapist. My entire practice is on the phone these days. So if you'd like to talk to me, you can go up on my website, click on email me, and say, I'd like to talk to you. And I'll email you back and we'll work it out. Also, you can reach on my email, on my website, on my email, Josh Hackney, who is my IT recording computer webs guru, and who makes sure that He makes sure to explain to me all the things I don't know how to do, and then to explain them to me again, and then explain them to me again. And remarkably, he does it with good grace and patience and kindness, a skill much to be desired. And so, as I say at the end of every show, if you have any of these needs, you want Josh Hackney, and you can get him by going up on my website. So, as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you didn't know, something you can use, something you did know but had forgotten, something that made you laugh, something that made you think, even something that annoyed you, but something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And boy, I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I freeze? Get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang.
My son was drinking too much. When did he spiral out of control? Should I have seen the warning signs? Somehow, I felt I was responsible for his drinking. I was very frustrated, and I knew I had to get help. When I came to Al-Anon, I wanted to straighten out my son's life. His drinking was tearing our family apart. In Al-Anon family groups, I found people who understood and cared because they were dealing with the same problems I was. My first Al-Anon meeting gave me hope and the knowledge that I was not alone.
Before you can help the problem drinker in your life, you need to help yourself first. For an Al-Anon family group meeting near you, call 1-888-4-ALANON, 1-888-425-2666. Online at www.alanonfamilygroups.org. That's alanonfamilygroups.org. A message from Al-Anon Family Groups.